Welcome to Your Health, the top stories from the Health Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis. In this week's program, the number of children born with Down syndrome goes up. Congress weighs in on breast cancer screening, and a suicide cluster in California puts parents on watch. But first, the number of children born with Down syndrome is going up. That's based on a study published in the Journal of Pediatrics, and it comes as a surprise to many who work in the field. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
The conventional wisdom was that because there's more prenatal screening, the rates of children born with Down syndrome was dropping. But the researchers found the numbers went up about 1% a year between 1979 and 2003.
It went up by 31%, from 9 per 10,000 births to 12 per 10,000 births.
That's Dr. Adolfo Correa. He's an epidemiologist at the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and co-author of the study. Correa says the main reason for the increase is probably the fact that more women wait longer to have children.
The prevalence of Down syndrome is 5 times higher among births to women who are 35 years of age and older.
There's another reason rates may be up, and that may be the higher visibility of children with Down syndrome themselves. They live longer and healthier lives. They get surgery for the heart defects that are common for about half of them. They go to their local schools, and some even go on to community college. Many get regular jobs.
In my community, which is a pretty upper-middle-class suburb of Detroit, Jordan is now working in a very public setting.
That's Cynthia Kidder, talking about her 20-year-old son, Jordan. He's got Down syndrome. He graduated from his neighborhood high school a year and a half ago, and 3 weeks ago, he started a job on the loading dock of a nearby store.
He's at a department store where people see him come and go. He loves to go to Starbucks. He rides his bike. Other friends like him are out at the Pistons games. They're coming and going in such normal, never-miss-a-beat fashion that it is becoming more accepted. There are many more positive experiences to look around and see.
So Kidder thinks people who know her son, if they ever get a prenatal diagnosis that indicates Down syndrome, are more likely to carry through with the pregnancy. Still, Dr. James Egan says these are very difficult decisions.
It's something that I think most mothers don't expect when they come in for an ultrasound or when they have a blood test looking for women at greater risk for Down syndrome. Most of the results are normal. Most of the results are reassuring.
Egan is a maternal fetal medicine specialist at the University of Connecticut. His own research shows the number of babies born with Down syndrome has held fairly steady. Still, it's far fewer than expected, given that so many women are giving birth at later ages.
Because our maternal population is aging, we would have expected more than twice as many Down syndrome babies in 2006 as in 1974, but we have only a slight increase.
The reason seems to be that there are better and more accurate diagnostic tests. Doctors now recommend that all pregnant women get tested for Down syndrome, not just older ones. And new tests can check even earlier, when it is easier to end a pregnancy. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Congress gets to grapple with some pretty tough scientific issues. What to do about climate change? Where the space program should be headed? Medical issues are especially challenging because they hit so close to home. This past week, members of Congress took up one of the thorniest medical questions, whether women in their 40s should routinely get mammograms. NPR's Joanne Silberna reports that the discussion got all tangled up with another tough one, healthcare overhaul.
The House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee hearing looked like it was going to be about the breast cancer screening recommendations issued last month by an independent government advisory committee. Dr. Diana Pitetti was there to defend the recommendations. She's the vice chair of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. She told the committee that her task force's recommendation against routine mammography for women in their 40s got totally overblown. The idea was that the exam shouldn't be automatic. Women should discuss the risks and benefits with their doctors before deciding.
What I thought would happen with these recommendations is that it would move the discussion more towards the notion of individualized decision-making and risk stratification.
Opponents of health overhaul legislation seized on the recommendation. They said that it meant that women in their 40s wouldn't be able to get mammograms under the House bill. But Michigan Democrat John Dingell told Petitti she was being vilified.
From the things I've heard said on the other side of the aisle about you folks at the agency, I was afraid you'd appear with horns, tail, fangs, and in a red suit breathing fire.
But Republicans were insistent that the task force's recommendations would become law. John Shadegg of Arizona said that in several of the new insurance plans that would be offered under the House bill, women in their 40s would have trouble getting mammograms.
Under Section 303 of H.R. 3962, women purchasing insurance under the first three categories, basic, enhanced, or premium, would not be allowed to purchase because the insurance company would not be allowed to offer a policy covering mammogram services.
It would be illegal, he said. But Section 303 does not specifically talk about mammograms. Section 303 refers to required basic benefits packages. Insurance plans would have to cover tests recommended by the Health Task Force. But as for tests like mammograms for women in their 40s, Democrats insist that the task force's guidelines are just a minimum, and the plans could cover more on their own or be required to cover more. And the Democrats accused Republicans of using scare tactics. Again, John Dingell.
These recommendations that we're going into this morning are recommendations, nothing more. And to say anything different than that is either to transmit the grossest kind of carelessness, and I hope this is not the case, or just plain outright deceit.
The debate brought an unusual apology to the authors of the guidelines from Subcommittee Chair Frank Pallone of New Jersey.
This has been totally politicized. I guess that's just the nature of the process around here, so I don't know what we can do about it or make it any different.
Meanwhile, on the other side of Capitol Hill, the Senate is considering amendments to its health overhaul bill. Early on the agenda, a plan to require insurers to cover, with no co-payments, preventive care for women, including mammograms for women under 50. Joanne Solberner, NPR News.
And now, preventing teenage suicide. Within the past 6 months, four teenagers in Palo Alto, California, from the same area high school, killed themselves. Now volunteers are maintaining a safety watch aimed at preventing another tragedy. Elaine Corey reports.
Twice each hour, the same routine unfolds. First, the warning bell sounds as the crossing gates lower to block this busy railroad intersection in a neighborhood of Palo Alto. 20 feet away, the parents, huddled along a chain-link fence, freeze mid-sentence and look down the tracks toward the approaching headlights. They watch as the massive silver commuter train bears down and then hurtles through the crossing. And then, just like that, it's over. The gates go up, faces relax, and the adults resume their quiet conversations.
Well, we're out here to show the community and the kids that we care about them, and that we want the misuse of the tracks to stop.
Caroline Cammy, the mother of two young children, started this track watch days after the last suicide occurred here a month ago. As school and city officials agonized and conferred, Cammy says she and other volunteers felt compelled to act.
We want the deaths to stop, and we want people to know that if they would just open their hearts and look around them, they'll find people who care. We're not the only ones.
An hour or two of my time every day is a small price to pay to keep anything from happening at this intersection. There's been no incident since we've been here.
Paul Gregg lives a quarter mile away. He has two children who graduated from Palo Alto schools. More than 70 volunteers have come to watch these tracks so far. They arrive in down jackets and knit caps, setting up camp chairs, sharing a thermos of coffee. Maria Elena Mendoza says she sleeps better if she stays until 1 a.m.
This way, I know I'm sure that 1 o'clock is the last train. I can go home and rest completely, knowing that there will be no more trains.
Mendoza has both a sophomore and a senior at the local high school. Two of the teens who died here were her son's classmates. He said each time counselors came to his class and said they had bad news. They never named the students, but everyone could see their empty chairs.
It is just not right that it's happening, that our kids have been put through this so much. They're just getting better from one and boom again and boom again, and they just can't survive like that.
There are no shrines erected here, no memorials to the four dead teenagers. No one wants to romanticize what happened. In fact, no one even uses the S word, instead referring to the incidents or the misuse of the tracks. The volunteers fear saying anything that could encourage another copycat. As the night wears on, people wave from passing cars or roll down their windows to yell thanks. A local pizzeria owner drops off a free pie, and sometimes the track watchers have visitors.
Are the paramedics on duty tonight?
Thank you.
Yeah, so we just want to thank you guys for doing what you do.
We figured we'd stop by and say hi. We'll say best of all.
Hugo Godoy and Steve Lindsay are Palo Alto firefighters.
Need anything? Anything we can do for you guys tonight?
The city of Palo Alto is providing 100 reflective safety vests for the volunteers to wear. And after months of delay, the police department recently hired security guards to patrol one site along the tracks. But the track watchers want more safety features, especially better lighting along the darkest stretches. In the meantime, they'll continue to guard this area. But for how long?
As long as it takes.
As long as I'm asked to come out, I'll come out.
Same thing, as long as it takes. We want to make sure that nothing will ever happen here again.
Parents say it'll be a long time before the memory of what happened begins to fade. They want troubled teens to know they can find answers, but not out here. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Corey.
Because these suicides took place at a specific location over a short period of time, scientists call it a suicide cluster. Michelle Trudeau has this report.
There are, on average, 5 suicide clusters a year in this country, according to psychiatric epidemiologist Madeline Gould at Columbia University. She says the most distinctive feature about suicide clusters is that they most frequently occur in teenagers.
Suicides following the exposure to someone's death by suicide was about 2 to 4 times higher among 15 to 19-year-olds than other age groups.
So what is it about teenagers that makes them particularly vulnerable to being part of a suicide cluster? Gould and other scientists say one thing is social modeling.
For adolescents, it's the peers that replace family members and other adults as the most influential group. And given that they are that influential, a suicide is another behavior that can be modeled, unfortunately.
Another feature about teens that puts them at suicide risk is their tendency to act impulsively. Their brains are still developing, so they're not good yet at putting on the brakes or planning ahead or problem solving. Suicide might seem like a solution to problems, especially if a friend or acquaintance has taken that route. But Gould stresses that the most significant red flag for adolescent suicide is mental health problems. In teens, that's most commonly depression, anxiety, alcohol, or drug abuse.
That's absolutely the major risk factor. Even in the context of someone else's suicide, without that underlying vulnerability, they're not going to go on to attempt suicide or die by suicide.
Gould is studying 50 suicide clusters that have occurred in the U.S. over the past decade, comparing them to young people who died by suicide but not in a cluster. She's doing what's called a psychological autopsy on each suicide, interviewing family, friends, teachers, checking school records, the teen's emails, phone calls, trying to identify what might initiate a suicide cluster.
Why do you have the tragedy of a suicide in one town, but it doesn't lead to additional suicides? Yet in another town, it may lead to 2 to 3 or 4 more suicides.
Gould has identified a crucial characteristic that plays a role in most clusters.
If the first suicide is a public suicide?
That is, if the first suicide gets media attention.
It's more apt to trigger other deaths.
So the way the media cover the first suicide is critical.
There is something called a dose-response association, so that the size of the increase in suicides following a suicide story is proportional to the amount and the duration and the prominence of the coverage.
Psychiatrist Paula Clayton, medical director of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, regularly advises the media on how to report on a suicide. reporting can actually help if, for example, the coverage includes the many factors that may have led up to the suicide and emphasizes that 90% of people who kill themselves have an underlying mental health problem. But there are also details of the suicide, Clayton cautions, that can increase the risk of suicide clusters that the media should avoid reporting on.
Don't talk about the method or show the place where the suicide occurred, and don't glorify it.
Clayton's group has also been consulting with the Palo Alto community about the recent suicide cluster there, telling them about the research on physical barriers and how effectively they prevent suicides.
So if you build barriers for bridges or put nets up, the suicide rates go down at the bridge and don't go up at the nearby bridges. If you build railroad barriers, the suicides go down.
In addition, in a new study by Madeline Gould coming out in December, the value of school-wide suicide screening is confirmed. Identifying teens at risk for suicide and offering them help does result in teenagers getting treatment for their mental health problems. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
And that's all for Your Health. We'll be back again next week with more. I'm Rebecca Davis. Thanks for listening.